Gordon, this is The Connection. Now, tell me if this feels familiar. You're standing forlornly at the supermarket cooler. You think beef would be nice, but, well, what about mad cow? So maybe salmon, but no, that's all farmed and full of PCBs. Chicken. They've killed thousands of birds in Maryland and Texas to get a handle on avian flu. Nah. You head over to produce. Let's see. There were problems with the green onions from Mexico. Grapes from Chile had spiders. We're still supposed to stay away from those Guatemalan raspberries. And wasn't there something about E. coli on the sprouts? And, of course, you can't even stop in the aisle that has pasta and bread because of those dreaded carbs. So what to do? Well, you grab a sushi to go. A plastic pack of raw fish product painted to look like crab, packed inside genetically modified rice with its own low-salt soy sauce. And then you stand in line looking at a tabloid newspaper with Paris Hilton promoting the Krispy Kreme diet. Why does it have to be so much work? How are we supposed to know what to eat? Are you plagued by food fears? Or do you think all this obsession with what we eat is just the luxury of people in a wealthy nation who can afford to pick and choose? This hour we are talking about our strange but passionate relationship with what we eat. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us in the checkout line today is Barbara Haber. She is a food historian and author of From Hardtack to Home Fries, An Uncommon History of American Cooks and Meals, now out in paperback. Barbara, it's nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And joining us from the NPR studios in New York is Bill Buford, staff writer and former fiction editor at The New Yorker magazine, author of an upcoming book, Heat, The Adventures of an Amateur Chef. Bill, it's good to have you with us as well.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Did I get the title of that book right, Heat, The Adventures of an Amateur Chef?
Well, the working title at the moment is a little more elaborate. It's The Adventures of an Amateur Chef as Kitchen Slave, Line Cook, Mountain Pasta Maker, Dante-quoting, raw pork-eating, sausage-making, butcher's apprentice on a hilltop in Tuscany.
Just checking.
Yeah.
Thank you. We're going to talk a little bit about your experience in restaurants and traveling overseas. I thought I'd start with Barbara here, just on the basic question that brings us together today, Barbara, and that is why it is that the choice of the food we eat seems like such a task.
Well, we're getting health messages every part of the day. It's in recent years that I think that you have 5 minutes of health news tacked onto every news broadcast, every television show. It's captivated the imaginations of the nation. It's a complicated story. Obviously, there are advocate groups around. But I really think that food hits a special nerve in people because we all have to eat. We all have to make food choices every day. And the fear factor is very prominent in people's minds. Instead of having to worry about starvation, as you sort of indicated in your intro, mm-hmm. people now have the luxury to worry about the little theoretical studies that are going on and the mass communication that's going on. Tufts, did you know, has a special program in health communications so that people are being trained both in nutrition and to be blabbing about, you know, what the latest issues are. And then the groups are coming out. I don't know if you remember Science in the Public Interest came out with stories against Chinese food, against fettuccine Alfredo, that certain foods were picked out by this group as saying that they were lethal, popcorn in movies and so on, which sent a message that there are bad foods and good foods. And I'll make myself clear at the start that I don't have that attitude. I feel that food is safe for the most part if you don't eat just one food all the time.
Bill, do you take this stuff seriously? Did you pause in January and say, oh, I was really enjoying that farmed salmon until the Science magazine article came out?
I think I've taken the attitude to be suspicious of quite a lot of the food anyways. I think my view might be summarized that I think food's too cheap. And we've got to a moment when beef and salmon and a lot of our raw meats are treated like Adidas shoes, and they can be marketed very commercially and aggressively, with the result that we've lost touch, I think, with what's good. You opened your program by a visit to the supermarket, and I realized I haven't been to a supermarket in probably many years, and that arises out of just wanting to know where my food's coming from, wanting to know. I think it's a very good practice to know your supplier on a first-name basis. And if you know that, then you're in a pretty good position.
Now, that is that easy to do in New York City?
It means traveling around a bit. I have the benefit of a little motor scooter, which has compressed the city into something even smaller. But I go to Benny for my meat, and I go to Paul for my pork, and I go to Lou for my cheese, and I know the name of the milk guy. And it just, I get to know where the food comes from. Frequently, I'll know what farmers it comes from. I'll know how it's been treated. And it's not as cheap as what you're going to get in the supermarket. But especially if you're dealing with if a part of your diet consists of eating what was once a live organism, if that's your philosophical position to food, then I think I want to know a little bit about that organism.
Part of my problem, Barbara, is that I want to get my food shopping done in as short a period of time as possible. I don't much enjoy it. I can tell listening to Bill describe it that he does. He's got the time,
right,
and can make it a pleasurable part of his week. But I would venture a guess that a lot of people either can't or choose not to invest that much time in.
I thought that as well. We don't have Vespas, and when you have a 9-to-5 job and kids at home and, you know, and laundry to be done, one-stop shopping is usually in the cards for women and men who share household responsibilities. And so I think Bill made it clear that it was a kind of luxury that he was able to afford.
Yeah.
in terms of time and money. Most people can't do that. And so they rely on the local market for their supplies.
Just before I leave the fantasy, though, Bill, is the food that you buy better tasting as well?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, I don't know if I would regard it as a luxury when you're talking about what you're going to put in yourself and what you're going to live on.
No, you're absolutely right.
I think if I'm going to buy fish, I want to know that it's fresh. In fact, once you actually get into buying local ingredients, then you actually discover how food is made, and you discover the ways you can make a certain dish last all week. You can discover the 10 different things you can do with the pork that you buy. It's not that it's taking that much time. It's just organizing your priorities in a different way.
And Barbara, when we talk about those things that we hear on the radio or read in the newspaper that steer us away from food, do you take them seriously when they say, you know, there's been an instance of mad cow? Do you stop eating beef?
I don't stop eating beef. It gives me pause to know that cattle are served the spinal cords of other dead animals. I think that there's something to be said about the way, in terms of providing cheap food, that the wrong kinds of ingredients are being poured into the troughs and animals are eating things that can pass on dangerous substances. And, you know, my habit now is when I buy beef is to try to buy pure food, you know, go to the stores that sell organic beef. When you hear these scares, it's just sort of human. And I think getting back to, you know, why people are so overwhelmed by these messages, I think there's a difference between one kind of risk and another, that we will take risks if we know there are risks, getting in a car, for instance, or getting on a plane. We have the information. But there's something awful about not knowing what the risk really is and being surprised by it. And I think that if we feel ourselves innocent about buying food and trusting, and then find out that there's some scary thing that can happen to you as a result of it, it's almost intolerable, and people will pull back and try to find some way of dealing with it.
So there's trust in the science when it comes out, or people are ready to hear what it is that they're being told. That's your view?
That's complicated as well. I think that there's now a growing mistrust of science. I think that the whole hysteria over GM, genetically
right.
modified food, over irradiated foods. From what I've read, irradiated foods do not make another head grow out of your neck, but they, in fact, do kill off germs and bacteria and would be a first step in safeguarding a lot of the fruits and vegetables, meats, and poultry and fish that we have from at least bacteria.
Bill, what about you?
I think it's a valuable lesson to be governed by your smell and your taste. And if something smells good and it tastes good, then it probably is good. The farmed salmon, which was I lived in Britain for nearly 20 years and was there when they didn't have farmed salmon, and then they did have farmed salmon, and suddenly all the salmon was very, very cheap. Farmed salmon often tastes like cardboard, and it's got a very funny color, and if you poke at it and then smell it and then eat it, it's not as satisfying as a fish should be. And the same is true of beef. When you actually sort of taste good beef, then you can tell something that's been mass-produced. I have to admit, I haven't been persuaded of that genetically modified foods is a bad thing either. And from what I can tell from my nose and my taste, I can't tell the difference yet. But I think it's your most reliable instrument is your nose.
I remember a story, though, from it was either Scotland or England at a time when the scare came out about the farmed salmon bill, that the people cut the prices of the salmon in the stores and then sold more than they were selling even before, which tells you something about exactly how much faith that the consumers are putting in those warnings or how much risk they're willing to accept if the price is right. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think that's actually at the heart of some of our biggest food problems of the last 50 years is that food's become very competitive, and there is a view that everybody should be entitled to a couple chickens in their pot and a steak on the stove and a salmon in the freezer. It's become an assumption that meat and fish are part of our daily diet and everyone can afford one. I take the sort of the Italian example, which is that you don't eat meat very much, and when you do, it's a very special thing, and you don't eat fish very much, and when you do, it's a very special thing, and you sort of prize this thing which has been slaughtered for your plate. I think a lot of what we're seeing is the ill consequences of the mass marketing of food that really can't stand to be mass marketed.
What are you eating pasta the rest of the time? I'm wondering, because that brings up a whole other major food message these days, which has to do with the Atkins diet and its duplicates.
Those evil carbs.
Yeah, the low carb thing. So when you're not eating that much chicken or fish or beef,
I have to admit, in my experiments of learning, I've spent 3 years as an amateur cook trying to learn how to cook. And one feature of my experiment was learning how to make pasta in the Italian way and doing it by hand and looking out for the special eggs and rolling it out and the whole business. And I gained a staggering amount of weight.
Case closed.
But you're a happier and a better person for that, are you not, Bill?
No, actually, the truth is that since January, I've only had one pasta, and I've sworn off the carbohydrates. It's really depressing.
Dear. Well, listen, our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to make some space for our foodie listeners when we come back after the break. And I think we should talk a little bit about the history of food scares, Barbara, when we come back, because we talk about this as if, Cyclospora discovered on the Guatemalan raspberries of 1995 was the first time we ever had worries or fears about the food that we eat. Of course, that's not the case.
That's
so,
right.
A reminder to our listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, and we'll be back with more talk about what we eat. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Bill Buford is with us on today's program as we talk about food. Bill was once a chef at Babbo, Mario Batali's restaurant in New York City, and then was so excited about that, spent some time in Italy exploring the even finer elements of cuisine in that country. Barbara Haber's here with me in Boston. She's the author of From Hardtack to Home Fries, An Uncommon History of American Cooks and Meals. She's also a food historian, and we should start right there with food history, Barbara, because how far back do we go to find a nation shivering in fear that it's supposed to be eating?
It's interesting. The term food scare, as far as I can tell, didn't emerge until the 1980s. But there certainly have been occasions and periods in our history where people were duly frightened about what they were eating. early 19th century, people were concerned about adulteration and fake medicine, patent medicines, all the scammers.
But adulterated food as well?
But adulterated food as well. Flour, other things were added to it to make the grain go farther, and bread would be baked without proper ingredients. Milk would be watered down. Butter, that was a big thing. Butter would be stretched in ways that got people concerned.
And so was the response to this wasn't people stopped drinking milk or eating bread, but were they begging for regulation?
Begging for regulations, particularly women's groups. We all know about the WCTU, the temperance ladies, but there are also groups of women who saw pure food as an extension of their own homes, a municipal domesticity, if you will, that was the obligation of mothers and wives to go into the community and to be sure that pure food and beverages and less alcohol were the rule of the day. It wasn't until 1906 that we had a national law, the Pure Food and Drug Act. And that took a lot. It took years and years of women activists working on behalf. And then along came the muckrakers. Do you remember reading about Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle? He was a socialist, and he wrote a novel, and his purpose was to talk about the poor immigrants and their terrible experiences in this country, and a meatpacking plant was the setting. And what happened is that the situation in the plant was so horrific, people drowning in vats of melted lard, being cut up and horrible. That what happened was that there was a whole uprising against impure meat and filthy conditions and all the rest of it. And that had a big effect on changing the law.
I mean, we could go back hundreds of years, I suppose, Bill, to take a look at why spices were introduced to, you know, help with the preservation of food and different ways that people were able to preserve their vegetables before we had refrigeration. Have we gone too far in the other direction? Are you one of these people who says, you know, I really shouldn't expect a rosy red tomato in January or eating strawberries in December if I'm living in New England?
Yeah, strawberries in December are pretty tempting, I have to admit. But it is a sort of it's a more satisfying thing, I think, to try to cook by the seasons and to govern your plate by the seasons to the extent you can. I mean, it takes a lot of learning to know what to do with the seasons when they produce it. There's always this adage that you hear from chefs of go to the market to find out what you're going to cook that night, and I'll go to the market and I'll be completely mystified by what I find there. I don't know what to do with all the things that I find there. but even so, I think it's the healthier way of eating. When you go back over when you look at food historically, and Barbara is much more of an authority on this than I am, but I'm always struck by the fact that there seems to be two things. There's certain absolutes. There's certain things that have always been good and always go well together. And there are things which are just crazily relative. For instance, I was thinking while you were talking about it, the tomato is, of course, a North American fruit. And although it's at the heart of the Italian diet, it was only when Columbus returned with the things that it was ever introduced to the Italian diet, but not at first, because initially the tomato was regarded as a poisonous thing. Or you go back, there's this belief that sort of the further back you go, the truer you're going to get. The food that people make for years and years and years and centuries and centuries has got to be sort of the most authentic. It's what I regard as sort of the authentic antiquity fallacy. If you go back to Roman times, what they ate was absolutely disgusting. They had this thing called garum, and garum was like their ketchup. And it consisted of taking fish entrails, salting them, sticking them in a pot in the hot sun, letting them ferment for 3 months, and then pulling them out and putting it on your dinner. I mean, it's on all their meals, and it's absolutely disgusting.
Yum.
Well, how different is it from the Asian fish sauces that are quite
actually
delicious?
No, that's very acute. And people who try to reproduce the Roman recipes, actually they're doing something, they'll do something, some of the Asian fish sauces. And in some ways, you're absolutely right. It's actually a little bit like soy. Mm-hmm. It's a very salty, dark thing that they put on their dishes. It passed. It wasn't a feature of their cooking. And then what, sort of 1,500 years later, suddenly everybody was into spices. And you look back at some of those medieval recipes and you think, well, sugar and ginger and cinnamon and nutmeg are yummy, but do I really want them on my pork and my roast beef and on everything else that you're going to serve me for dinner?
All right, Connection listeners, how do you decide what is safe to eat? How much do you worry about the daily headlines that tell you you can't eat these grapes or those onions or that chicken? There was a headline in one of the British newspapers. I scribbled it down somewhere, and I'm not going to be able to find it here, but it was something like bird flu going to be worse than SARS. And that's in many ways the way that we consume the news about the food that we're trying to consume. So how do you make sense of it all? 1-800-423-8255. We're going to go first to Greensboro, North Carolina. Miranda is with us. Miranda, thanks for calling.
Hello. I want to thank you for doing the show. I think you're raising a lot of really important issues, and one of the things that I would kind of like to bring up that I think both Bill
and Barbara
have raised, corporate and consumer responsibility. I think there needs to be an even balance of those two things. I liked that you brought up the issue of convenience, because I think in a lot of ways that is sold to us as a point where we're supposed to be willing to accept second best simply because we don't have the time to do otherwise. And I think that if consumers really looked at that and considered the fact that, you know, this is our food that we are talking about, and that we do have a right in the wealthiest nation in the world, I think we have a right to have acceptable food. And, of course, it always goes back to the corporations, because they're the ones who are grinding up spinal cords, I think Barbara mentioned.
But let's for a minute here, Miranda, be fair to the corporations. And Barbara, take me back into the history for a bit here, because it was it the 50s or the 60s where cake mixes, for example, became this magical way of saving yourself all the trouble of producing something wonderful?
Right, 50s, I think. Uh-huh.
Now, that you can say, you know, good on Sara Lee for coming up with something that people are going to pay for, but it was the consumers who wanted that.
I sort of go back to joining Bill in the sense that I think if consumers really knew how to shop and how to cook, that they could knock off a meal and a cake in about the same time that a lot of these convenience foods do. Yeah, sure. I can do a dinner in 10 minutes. You know, if you buy baby spinach and know how to and have good olive oil on hand and a little garlic, you know, you get a good side
dish. It's a little close to lunchtime for getting two
Or if you cook fish or scallops, as I did last night,
right.
I can you know, you dare not overcook scallops. So 5 or 10 minutes, you know, the whole dish in a quick saute and then a grill. The meal is on the table in under 15 minutes, and maybe a good bread and a glass of wine and thou, you know. So that I keep coming back to this when I talk about this, is that if people really knew how to shop and really knew how certain vegetables, how quickly they ought to be cooked and how easy it is to grill all different kinds of food, they wouldn't be dependent on those foods. But now going back to the corporations, from their point of view, they're in the job of selling and selling more and more every year, growing their companies. And so they have to come up with new combinations of boxes of prepared foods that will appeal to the general public.
Bill, when you were in Italy, what were you watching there in the way that people were purchasing and consuming their food? Were people relying on government regulation? Was there a greater sensitivity about certain foods? What's the contrast that you saw?
Well, the European community was a presence in a way that it wasn't before, and they've come with a whole textbook of regulations, but that was more an obstacle. I mean, I was in a lot of ways, I was in a dream situation. I was for 6 months on a hilltop in Tuscany working with a mad butcher who quoted Dante all day long, and who was famous for coming up with this very, very precious beef and this very precious pork, and people would drive for miles and miles first to hear his Dante and then to buy his beef and his pork. What was interesting, I was listening to Barbara, what was interesting there was the premium that was put on olive oil in a way that you just cannot imagine. One, they get better olive oil there, and it sort of proves the notion that you really should try to get young olive oil, and it's worth spending some money on olive oil because it's just such a wonderful feature of your meal. But they used it in copious quantities. So very simple dishes like chickpeas. They'd make chickpeas for lunch. We'd have family meal in the butcher shop at 2 o'clock, and one One routine thing was to make chickpeas with salt, pepper, Parmigiano cheese, and lots of olive oil. And it was fantastic. It was a very, very simple dish, but it was because the olive oil was a feature of the dish. It was it was something that you could put together very, very quickly.
Let's go to Lincoln, Massachusetts now. Sam's joining us on the line from there. Sam, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. I was wondering if the guests could address the our habit of producing food and the agribusiness way of doing it results in incredible environmental degradation. And I was wondering if the guests could address the health risks associated with that environmental degradation.
Be a little more specific for me, Sam. Are you saying that is the cost of that cleanup built into the cost of a pound of bacon from the pig farm?
Well, there's definitely the accounting of it, but also just the health risks of being in an environment that's polluted by nitrogen, the effluent and the runoff that goes into the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, I go on and on. I don't know where you want me to stop, but the point being there's an accounting figure that has to be done, but just the health risks of living in a polluted environment.
Well, in many ways, it goes back to those three things that I spoke about at the beginning of the program, doesn't it, Barbara? That the reason there's mad cow is because of the way that the beef is produced and flayed off the skeleton. The reason that there's a problem with the farmed salmon is because there is farmed salmon.
Well,
you know,
and he's talking about chemical fertilizers, and he's talking about pesticides is how I understood his question. Going back in history, you know, adulteration was the big theme, as I see it, in 19th century American food concerns. And then later on, particularly after the publication of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, people were terribly concerned about these issues of DDT in her day and fertilizers and all the rest of it. And at the same time, Jerome Rodale, who was the grandfather of the organic food movement, talked about how we can grow food without any of these chemical resources and therefore protect the water and all the rest of it. And I think, we all know that every normal supermarket now has organic as a choice. It'll be more expensive, but our organic foods are now available nationwide, I think as a result of this last caller's concerns.
Okay, but Bill, join us on this, because when we talk
I think he's the caller's also describing something that was described in Fast Food Nation, which is that when you have giant suppliers like McDonald's, which is making, how many billions of French fries every year and how many millions of hamburgers, then they've actually got to seek out parts of the country where nobody lives for their feeding lots, where they fatten up their cows, because there is actually so much cow poo that's produced by these many cows that it's actually a chemical risk to anybody who's in that area. And I think, again, it's a feature of producing mass market food. I mean, the same thing is happening with the way they produce pork now and the way they produce bacon. I would hesitate before blaming corporations, because corporations, as you said, are only in the business of doing what they're doing. And if you're not going to buy what they're making, then they're not going to be in that business. And you don't have to buy what they do. I don't feel like I should call for legislation to curb the corporations. I just want to sort of do my vote by going someplace else to buy my meat. And I would go to a place that, in an ideal world, the animals are made in, raised in small farms, and you don't have the blight of acres of cow poo. But in fact, it just goes back into the land as normal fertilizer.
Okay, but you're not going to be able to buy a $3, $4 steak from the type of butcher that Bill's describing. And one of the places, Barbara, where we keep ending up here is that all the choices that are more attractive than what's currently available all more expensive.
Exactly right.
The smaller farms.
Up to a point, though. You cannot buy a $3 or $4 steak, but for $3 or $4, you can get the shank, and then you just learn how to do with the shank. And for even less than that, you can get the shoulder, and you can do a lot with the shoulder. The most popular dish in New York is short ribs. Every restaurant in New York has short ribs. It's just one of those weird kitchen fads where one kitchen starts doing short ribs and then another kitchen does short ribs. Short ribs were costing, until every kitchen in New York was doing it, was costing $1.50 a pound. And this is this Danielle's, Jean-Georges, Babo, as well as the Korean restaurants and the Asian restaurants, they're all doing short ribs. It's a very cheap dish. for which you can charge a lot of money.
I think we all have a fantasy of an ideal world when we can drive 30 minutes and get our eggs and pick out a cow or a pig to be slaughtered. And we have a big freezer where we can put all these meat in. And the animals have names and we know who they were and how, you know, we saw them as children and all the rest of it. But when you're dealing with food on the scale of this nation, we come up against the whole question of, do we feed people at lower prices or do we just feed certain people at more expensive prices?
Let's go to Boston, to Mizrak, who's joining us on the line. Mizrak, thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me.
So what do you think?
I have two observations. I run a restaurant in Boston, and the restaurant has been there about 15 years, and people were coming and having, like, they have their own selection of, like, I want the spicy beef, I want the spicy chicken, I want this. Now we have question that's never been asked before. And the waitresses are, this customer is asking me, where do you get the beef?
That's a good thing, isn't it, Mizrak?
Yeah, I mean, you know you're getting it from the wholesalers, but you never ask where is it coming from.
So you know, when do you ask the wholesaler now?
Right, yeah. Now, when there was a problem in Canada, customers who've been coming for 5 years and eating the same thing and asking a question, do you get your beef from Canada? I was like, I have no idea. I have to ask the wholesaler. So now we have to get the information. Where do you get the beef? And people who have been eating beef or chicken, and we have a lot of vegetarian, which is vegan, and people who say, you know, rather today I'm going to change. I'm going to eat you're vegetarian. I'm not vegetarian, but I'm going to change. And you see that change a lot, you know, being in the restaurant business for a long time. It's like amazing question that you never think about.
But these are good to have people ask these questions, is it
yeah,
not?
Yeah, it is. It is.
All right, Mizrak, thanks for calling. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take a short break right now and come back and talk a little bit more about the safety of the food we eat, questions that we can and should be asking about that food, and why it is we are so obsessed with this choice that comes our way 2, 3, 4, for some of us, 5, 6 times a day. What do we eat? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're talking about what we eat and inviting you to join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Bill Buford is with us from New York. He's staff writer and former fiction editor of The New Yorker magazine and is working on a book. One of its working titles is Heat, The Adventures of an Amateur Chef. Barbara Haber's here in the studio with me. She's a food historian and author of From Hard Tack to Home Fries, now out in paperback. Barbara, we should start this part of the program with just a sort of response to what Mizrak was saying. It seems to me a good thing when everybody starts to ask those questions.
Well, it indicated to me that they had just heard the latest health message. They wanted to be sure that the steak or hamburger they were about to bite into didn't come from cattle from Canada, mm-hmm. Because that's where the latest episode of the mad cow had arisen.
But are you saying that it's kind of a temporal, fickle response, that it's not going to teach us to ask where that package of asparagus comes from?
That's what I think. I really think that it is a direct response to whatever the food scare of that day or that week was all about. And they wanted at least to feel that if the cattle they were eating came from Missouri or Chicago, that they would be safe for now.
Not really wanted to know what the
I don't think
food
so.
Yard was like.
I don't think they'd be horrified for some other reason if they really found out.
Bill, you got some strange looks not long ago by taking a large piece of meat on the back of your Vespa scooter. What's the story there?
It was actually on the front. I got a rack on the front of the Vespa. I think I was taking this Know Your Source material, Know Your Supplier, a bit too seriously. Paul, the guy at the Union Square Market who normally sells chickens, told me that he could get some organic pork, and but I had to order the whole pig. And I just returned from Italy, where I had learned what to do with a pig and was keen to try it. So I ordered a pig, and I realized how seldom that is done in New York. Because the pig was ordered by me, it didn't have to be USDA inspected. He just went out into the yard the next day and killed a pig, and then brought it in. and gave me the pig. He cut it in half for me, which was helpful. But otherwise, he just wrapped it up in transparent plastic, and I bundled it up with some difficulty on my Vespa and then brought it home. And then I realized this was coming into my building.
Wait a second. How big is this pig? How many pounds of meat?
It was a couple hundred pounds. It was a big, you know, there were hooves draped off my side. There was a head. He asked me, you know, at the last minute, did I want the lungs? I said, nah, skip the lungs this time, but maybe next time. And I then got into the elevator, and I realized why buildings in New York have service elevators, and I felt like I was violating some important health code by bringing in this pig into the elevator. And then just as the door was about to close, some Wall Street guy comes racing in saying, hold the elevator! I thought, oh, you don't want to do that. And sure enough, the doorman didn't. He rushed in and then glanced over and saw a hoof and a head and an ear and lurched. The doorman observed that there were sounds coming out of him that really weren't encouraging. And then I had this pig. But I was astonished then, having had a pig in my apartment, which also felt like it was violating some kind of health code, that it takes a lot of work, you know, when you bring home a pig. But I probably got, I don't know, 750 meals out of it. I mean, admittedly, I had to work several days on my pig, but I made roasts out of the shoulders. I did stuff with the pig feet. I boned the body and made this thing called arista, where you take out the bones and you put in garlic and rosemary and salt and pepper and fennel, and you roast it all together, and you get like bacon on the bottom and the filet on the top. I salted the legs. I made sausages. I made sausages, you know, for like 150 years.
How much time did you spend with this pig, all told?
Well, Pig and I got quite intimate. we were close. It was an on and off thing. For instance, I salted the legs and then cooked them in wine overnight. So it was a week of stuff. It was probably a week of stuff, all in all.
And huge freezer space, I would think, for New York anyway.
Well, what I was trying to do was not freeze anything. Actually, mm-hmm. I was trying to do it in a way where, with the exception of I made a ragu. And that I did freeze, a kind of bolognese ragu. But I'm of the view that freezing meat ruins it, because when it defrosts, all the good stuff goes out with the liquid. All the cells which have the flavor and all the blood goes out with the liquid. And frozen meat tastes different from fresh meat. So I was holding to an Italian view, and actually kind of a restaurant view, that you should try to figure out how to do your meat so you don't have to freeze it.
Then you must have entertained a lot, Bill.
I did have, you know, you got a pig, then you got to invite some friends around. That's true.
All right. So there's one way of coping with it. 1-800-423-8255. Questions, answers from you, Connection listeners. Let's go to Marblehead, Massachusetts, and Robin's with us. Hi, Robin.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was wondering if Barbara could comment on when all of these refined foods, white sugar, white flour, white rice,
enriched flour, yeah.
Uh-huh. Sorry, yeah. All that stuff sort of became the norm. Instead of, you know, when did we sort of forget about whole wheat and the whole grain? When did we make that switch?
I think in the 19th century there was a feeling that white bread was preferable, that it, just as we call the flour refined, the food as it made with that flour would be more refined, whereas bread that was more coarsely concocted was more peasanty, and it went on early in the 19th century, the switch to more refined white flour. And then when you had certain technology developing in the Middle West of Minnesota, where the flour mills were, it was even easier to create a really refined flour. And one of the major food reformers of the 19th century, a man named Sylvester Graham, was quite ingenious in terms of getting his following. He was vegetarian, and he was anti-sex and anti-alcohol and a lot of other things. But one of the main things that he talked about was we should go back to eating the whole wheat. And he made a whole credo of it and started the trend then away from the refined foods, including sugar, back to using all of the grain. And that was picked up by a lot of other food reformers all the way into the 20th century.
1-800-423-8255. Robin, thanks for that. To Newton, Massachusetts now, and Victoria's with us. Victoria, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, I know who this is, Victoria Abbott.
Yes,
right?
I write about food and nutrition, and I thought that part of the confusion comes from the fact that we've got new research, which I think is a good thing as we learn about nutrition and medicine and the ways that the foods we eat actually affect our health. And I have to say something about the pasta, for example, that it's actually, some research I've done, it's a good carbohydrate because it's made with durum wheat and high in protein and therefore doesn't raise blood sugar. But, you know, we had to learn the hard way, say, about trans fatty acids, and we thought, okay, margarine's good. But then the research comes out and people say, but wait a minute, now I'm confused. But part of that is because we're learning more and more.
But let me just stop you for a half a second, Victoria. You may be learning more and more, but I'm getting more and more confused when I look at a package of pasta. For example, in some countries, you can look up the glycemic index of
right.
that pasta because that's something that the government mandates is printed there. In this case, it's fat or it's carbohydrates. And I mean, for the people who are just trying to consume the food rather than understand it and write about it, doesn't it just get harder and harder rather than easier and easier?
Well, it does certainly make people pause because they'll say, well, wait a minute, I read that coffee was good or coffee was bad. But I guess my point is that there is confusion, and that's something obviously that's out there. But at the same time, we're doing a good thing by saying, look, we now know that nuts, for example, can help reduce the risk of heart disease. And so as we move forward in our knowledge, sort of the fallout is the fact that there is a little confusion along the way, but I think ultimately the end goal is that we're helping educate people in terms of what is good and what they should choose.
Barbara, you wanted to get in here.
Yeah, I think a lot of the confusion comes from the lab animals, the rats and the mice, and as I understand it, they're bred to be cancer prone. So they'll be given a product and they get cancer, and then all of a sudden the health message goes out that such and such a thing is bad for you. Alar, which
was
used
apples, right?
For apples to keep them from falling down from trees prematurely, there was a horrible health craze about it. Meryl Streep crying on television in front of Congress is the image that I recall because she really believed that her four kids would be endangered if they drank apple juice. And then come to find out, a human being would have had to have 1,000 quarts of apple juice in it to approximate what the mouse had in the laboratory. And there's just no way that people could consume that much. And there's this fuzzy assumption that because the mouse gets sick, so will we, which is not good science. And it makes everybody crazy.
Bill, do you read the labels?
I do. And I don't want to come across as a market romantic, but I can't help but feel that a lot of the issues arise out of the question that the caller but one raised, which is we are at the end of an era of enriched, processed sugars and processed flours and highly processed food. And a lot of our problems and a lot of our difficulties with sugars and carbohydrates at the moment are the fact that we've been living on such a processed diet
mm-hmm.
that we're at a point where we've got to make ourselves healthy, I think, and rid ourselves of a kind of mass market, fast food, fast processed food,
commodity
no
happy
culture
meals,
that we've
Bill?
Got. I'm sorry?
No happy meals?
Well, no, that's what I mean. I think that it means happier meals. I mean,
the real
meals
happy meals.
Well, the meals Barbara was describing with a bit of fish and some olive oil and some grilled and doing something with spinach, or the other night I was doing stuff with Swiss chard, which I had never cooked before, and
that's great stuff. Yeah, eating simply.
I did a lamb shoulder, which it was only recently that I ever started cooking a lamb shoulder. You cook it for 3 or 4 hours, but then you got a meal for the entire week, and it's absolutely delicious, and it's very mm-hmm. simple, and it doesn't have any of these things that we're talking about in it. It's just, it's very, very good food, and it's not expensive.
I absolutely agree with that. It's about knowing how to shop and knowing how to cook.
Let me go to Sherburne, Massachusetts. Now Karen's on the line there. Hi, Karen. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just opened a small cafe in Framingham, Massachusetts, with a mission to provide consciously sourced, as responsible as we can, food through local farms, but also to keep the price point reasonable so more people could access that kind of food. And It's really challenging because when you're making fresh food, also the labor is an issue. But I think, you know, the bigger issue to this is that we all have to look at the worth of spending the time and energy, and for those of us who can afford it, the money to start a different food system and make it viable for everyone.
Karen, let me ask you something. If I were to come into a cafe like yours and order bacon and eggs and potatoes and toast, you know, I might be able to get that for as little as $3.99 at some greasy spoon somewhere, but nobody knows where the eggs and the flour and the bacon all came from. In a world that you're describing, how much more are you saying people would pay for a breakfast?
Well, I think you change portions. I mean, as an example, lunch can be anywhere from $5 to $8 that we've experienced, and people have no problem with that because they know that they're getting really good local organic salad greens, that we're going to be introducing local food as we go along, and people are starting to understand that there are other prices associated with the purchase of food that are beyond what the actual cost of the meal is. And I think as people become more educated, they will start seeking it out. But it also means that business owners have to take a leap of faith and put that out in the world and be willing to work extra hard. As an example, farmers can't deliver on a regular basis and leave their farms.
Right.
So it means that maybe I'm going to be doing a pickup and he'll be doing a delivery. We need to start creating communities of food where we live and engaging people at every level so that they see the benefits. Health-wise, nutrition, you know.
Are we going in this direction, Barbara, in your view?
Well, I was thinking of Alice Waters, for instance, who was teaching kids, grade school kids.
Setting up the gardens.
Setting up
the
gardens,
yeah.
Right. And it's, you know, it's a Berkeley thing, and it can work, you know, better in California than it can here. But basically, I agree with this caller that education is lacking in food, that the people whose mothers didn't cook and were given fast food are carrying on those traditions. And we have a lot of work to do with kids through education.
Well, we're out of time, and that's probably a good thing because it's lunchtime. Barbara, thank you so much for coming in.
You're very welcome.
Barbara Haber's a food historian and author of From Hard Tack to Home Fries. Bill Buford, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Bill is a staff writer and former fiction editor of The New Yorker. His upcoming book is Heat, The Adventures of an Amateur Chef. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Mashed potatoes. Hey, sweet potatoes. Baked potatoes. Potato chips. Whoa! Smoked sausage. Fried chicken. Pepperoni pizza. Tenderloin chips. Nobody can make a donut do the things you do. Believe me, baby, believe me, baby.